This webcast is sponsored by...
I'm only kidding, I haven't got a sponsor. But if you search Shay Kelly on Amazon, you'll see my books. You can buy them if you want. My mum says they're really good. Do you really have nothing better to do with your life than listen to me talk to behaviour experts about dogs? Then this is your kind of show. Sit yourself down, eardrums at the ready, we're going in. Hello everyone, welcome to Just Shaying. This week my special guest is Denise Armstrong. Denise has a master's degree with distinction in clinical animal behaviour from University of Lincoln, no less, which has a very good name in the industry. A member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers, vice chair, member of Victoria Stilwell Positively Dog Training, candidate member of the Fellowship of Animal Behaviour Clinicians, runs dog training classes and one-to-ones. She lives 11 miles from my house, but I don't think we've ever met. Special interests include grumpy dogs, life skills for puppies, and appearing on the Just Shaying podcast. It's Denise Armstrong. Welcome to the show, Denise. How are you?
Thank you. I'm good. It's a glorious day to be here as well. So
it's about time we had some sunshine, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. And I can't believe we live so close and we've never met. Yeah.
We probably have and not known it. We must have been at the same behaviour conference or workshop or something at some time. Yeah. Denise, why are you in all these different organisations that I've just read out? Are they not very good? So you have to be in loads of them.
No, so it's all been part of that weird journey that I've been on, and I used to be in full members of other organizations, and so it's all part of that roller coaster journey that I started must be 26 possible years ago. And it starts with, as it always does, the dog that gives you issues. And then you, and then you end up all of a sudden thinking, I want to know more, go on courses, you do this, you do that. And then you say, oh, I can teach people this as well. And so you start becoming an accredited person. And then as you go down the other side of the roller coaster ride, you start to narrow it down a bit. So some of those organizations I'm still member of, I'm a member of the Association of Pet Dog Trainers as an accredited person that allows me to practice as a dog trainer. And it gives clients the assurance that I have been assessed, checked out, sort of know what I'm doing. And equally, and this will come onto one of my pet peeves later on, but equally it gives any clients recourse should they be dissatisfied with anything I'm doing, but it keeps me holding up to a standard. And I became a Victoria Stilwell pet dog trainers by virtue of I was coaching one of their members, and I thought, yeah, I quite like what she does as well, and yes, why not? It gave me a really nice another viewpoint on the world, very, very similar to the APDT. And something that I haven't mentioned in one of my accreditations I'm still a member of is the Gun Dog Trainers Academy. Oh, yeah. So I'm one of the founding members of those, and that's part of another story of my journey. And as far as the FABC, so the FABC, the Fellowship of Animal Behaviour.
That sounds very posh, that one.
Yeah, so it's a very new, relatively new organisation, and it's part of the continuing journey towards being an accredited clinical, certified clinical animal behaviourist, CCAB. We love our acronyms in this business. I just go by colours of logos, so I tend to say the green company or the blue company or the brown company or the red company. So the fellowship is... a much more veterinarian sort of approach to clinical animal behaviour. There's a lot of veterinarians, I can never say the word, who are members of that organisation. And it started a couple of years ago as I completed my master's degree at University of Lincoln. And Professor Daniel Mills is on part of the beginning of that, and he encouraged us to join either one of those, the APBC or preferably the fellowship, because of what their ethos and their background was. but I'm a candidate member, which means I'm working towards my final certification, which is through the CCAB, which allows me to become a full member of the FABC.
I always wonder why you've got to work towards something for these organisations. I think you've already got your qualification, haven't you? You've done your years at Lincoln, which is a very high standard university in the animal world.
Yeah, I think the reason that sits there is because once you've done your master's, you have the technical and the theoretical knowledge. The final part is that practical.
Yeah.
Can you demonstrate that you can put in practice what you theoretically understand and demonstrate through presentation of clinical cases that you have either worked through or now under guidance through the accrediting body? So I fully get that, you know, you just can't be let loose on the world, although part of my pet peeve, which we will talk about later, is that just because we've done courses doesn't necessarily mean to say that you can actually practically apply those skills.
Might be one of my pet peeves as well. But you make, I am a bit cynical of all these different organisations. I'm cynical of most things, but you make a very, very good point in that, because I think about my daughter's career. She's in accountancy for local government. When she got her degree, she then goes into accountancy and starts at the bottom in the organisation, and there's other qualifications you've got to do and you work your way up. Nobody thinks you're an expert just because you've got a degree in accountancy. But in the animal world, you tend to say, oh, I've got this degree, and everyone just assumes that, oh, you must know everything there is to know about everything in the animal world. And it's not quite like that, is it? I've probably forgotten 80% of what I did on my course, to be honest.
I mean, I absolutely love the theory. And again, part of that journey is one of my favourite courses that I've ever done was Gene Donaldson's academy, Dog Training Academy. It's not recognised as a qualification in the UK, but she's very, very Skinnerian based, you know, plan, action, step checks and all of these things. And the quality of the scientific knowledge that you learned through her was just phenomenal. It stands me instead now to this very day. I mean, most people talk about things like, oh, the science is really boring, but you need to understand the science in order to understand why something possibly is working or not in order to support the rest of the journey that you're going on with the dog. But yeah, I mean, my previous job is, I always refer to sometimes my previous job, which was air traffic control. And there it's the same principle. You would go through the college. They had a college where you would go and you would study the theory side of it all. You'd have minor assessments along the way, which involve practicals. But when you come out the other side, you're not let loose. You're not let loose at all. You then join a unit. Mine was Stansted. You then join a unit and you can spend upwards, depending on the unit that you're at, up to 12 months, 18 months training on the job and being assessed and certified and examined until you reach the point where, yes, you have now demonstrated, you can now apply all that practical knowledge in this real world environment. And yeah, that's for me.
Surely,
part of it.
Surely them planes just land themselves, don't they, on autopilot. Denise, we're going to a section of the show which I call Expert in the Room. So this is where I ask you a few things about the things you're particularly interested in and how this can help other people out there in the world with their dogs. And so your areas are grumpy dogs, life skills for puppies, and people skills. So grumpy dogs, you say that you get sent challenging dogs quite often who struggle in other people's classes. And so what are you doing different for these dogs in your class that they're able to be successful when they haven't been previously?
So a lot of it is the other end of the lead, which is the person. And it's helping the person not feel ostracized or excluded from a class because their dog is really upset and unable to deal with the presence potentially of other dogs or has had bad experiences. And we're really, really lucky in that we have an enormous field that I train in, which is the adventure bark. So I have at my luxury and pleasure oodles of space. We use barriers as well, but before they come to class, we'll record welfare within a class is like right up there for me. And that's why I run now very small classes. I only have four in a class now. We used to do six. So we have four in a class. So even if we have an upset dog, we identify them literally as they walk into the field and they struggle. So we put in place, we have lots of things, activities. We actually have an assistant and we have the old snuffle mats. We have barriers. We have chews. We have space. We have just pause and breathe. Most of the time it's for the dog and the owner. So it's just recognizing what you're seeing and why the dog is struggling. And I like to think of it as a struggle in that current environment. And then if I think that potentially the class is not the right environment at the moment for this particular dog, then I will refer them into a one-to-one and explain why, you know, and helping the owners understand that it's not their fault. It's not the dog's fault. There's just a struggle going on. What can I do? As Jean Donaldson calls it, how upset is this dog? On a scale of 1 to 10, is it mildly upset? In which case, if it's a mildly upset, then probably a class environment's okay. And it's helping the dog learn to disengage, and it's positioning of the other dogs in the class. So sometimes I do take adolescent dogs and we put them in the puppy class, because the puppy class is a perfect environment for everybody to work from the beginning and the ground upwards, and know that we need distance and we need space and we need to disengage and all of those sorts of things. But if I have a seriously upset dog, then classes would not be the right environment for us to take them in. So we usually have a conversation before they join. But we do get some people who come from those sorts of environments where I was sent to the corner of the field, but they've been sent to the corner of the field with no explanation as to why or support to help them through what's going on. But
yeah, so we always remember the bad experiences in life better than the more than the pleasant experiences. And so when I was thinking about this and thinking about your grumpy dogs in classes, I'm thinking back years ago when I was in a training hall in a big community hall, and there must have been 20 to 30 dogs each week, and you'd get dogs coming in that were before I knew a lot about dog training, I was just starting out, you'd get dogs coming in that totally shouldn't have been there, weren't appropriate. They were barking all the way through it, or they was whining all the way through it. They were stressed at everything all the way through it. And you would see these dogs week after week after week after week, and they never improved, probably got worse because you're repeatedly taking them into that environment. So what you, the setup is so important, isn't it?
Yeah. Or they shut down and they look like they're behaving, you know? And I think, yeah, so our setup, like I say, is we have four dogs. Sometimes we have six, depending on the mix, but it's currently four is my preferred option for classes. Even for the activity classes like the agility that we run, we prefer four. It's an easier environment to get on. But like you say, I was the same. I went to a hall. You have no idea. I come from the days of yellow pages where you used to look up, who do I go see for a dog training, you know? So,
One of my classes before I started studying dog training came from the Harlow Star. They used to advertise in there every week. And when I think back now to how awful it was really for the dogs, it wasn't for most of the dogs, it wasn't a pleasant experience at all.
I reflect the same. I still to this day, one of my dearly departed setters, still to this day, I have this picture, this little video picture running through my mind. He was such a tolerant dog. I mean, I was blessed with him, but I see him in this gun dog lineup, and there was about 10 dogs. And we were trying to do this 6-day walk away. And it's like, my dog was right at the very end. And I'm looking at him. I look back in hindsight with different eyes and I look at him and he's like leaning away from all the other dogs watching me. And then goes, can't deal with this, mum, and breaks the sit-stay. And the instructor tells you what to do. And you keep repeating this, and the sit keeps being set up for failure, obviously, because I didn't know any different. But I just see him and I'm looking and he's leaning away. And I'm thinking, in hindsight, you really didn't want to be there. You did not like the pressure you were being put under. You didn't like the way I was handling you, everything. It's just, yeah, we're there. I've moved on. I have become educated.
One of the things we had to do is swap dogs with somebody else. So they handled your dog. And it was a German Shepherd training club. So most of them were German Shepherds, one or two others. Totally horrendous for my dog. Didn't, you know, in a strange place, a little place, didn't want to be there anyway. And then they're separated from their person who they trust and but can still see them over there, the other side of the room with another dog. I've still got no idea what it was supposed to do. I've not worked out even with education what the trainer was even trying to do. But you also one of your interests are life skills for puppies, and I think that's probably one of the most common things that people want to know, isn't it? How to look after their puppy. It's, you know, they get a new pup, that's when they're looking at buying books, and that's why just about everybody's written a dog book with puppy in the title at some time. It's just trillions of them. You wouldn't know what to pick, would you? But what advice do you give people for raising pups for the world?
Lots. So it's a really tricky balance. As a puppy class deliverer, people have this concept of, I need to go to puppy class to help teach my dog learn to sit and lie down and do this. Well, we do those sorts of things. However, we put them into a realistic environment. You might want to use sit-stay weight, for example, to go and pick up your poop and pop it in the bin or help your dog learn to settle. But my top tip for puppy owners is to try to get across that socialisation is not what you think it is. Socialisation is about exposing your dog to the world within which they are going to live in first and foremost. And that might mean the house. So when you first bring your puppy home, let the dog get used to the house before you bring over the hordes of visitors. Give the dog a period of decompression from the puppy, a period of decompression from being torn apart from its litter mates and its mother. Just think of it from that more welfare perspective. And how suddenly this dog is thrown into a new environment, help them. Give them that choice. Don't overwhelm them. Let them meet the grass, the trees, the other dog slowly, the cat slowly. Don't take them out and expose them and expect them to understand. Watson, it's one of my dogs. I can see he's on alert in nose. I've got one at my feet and one snuffling in the cupboard just in front of me and one outside. And it's about taking your time. They don't come pre-programmed. They don't come with one size fits all. And having a child, he's now 22, and if they have children, I always put your mindset into how it was when you first brought your baby home. There's all these books and manuals out there, but you still don't know what to do. Take a breath, take it slowly, and don't be in a rush to expose your dog to too much. It's about being, I like to call it mindful, being mindful about what it is that you're doing with your puppy. Build that resilience up, become more aware of, rather than dropping your dog in the deep end, your puppy in at the deep end, and making it potentially more scared of something, allow it under its own steam to explore something. And don't worry about it if it doesn't like it. Distance is your friend. I always say distance is your friend. Small bites. Bring them back the next day a little bit closer if they can. But don't force them to do things. In our puppy courses, I use a fair bit of the agility equipment and we introduce tunnels. And I love doing that one because we can show the owners what we mean by allow your dog to choose to do this. And here's how you set the choice up. choose to enter, be brave to enter. But instead of entering the big, like, 5-meter tunnel or the 3-meter tunnel from the off, can he step through a hoop, as nuts as it sounds? Can he step through 3 hoops in a row, so it's a bit of a wider band? Can he step through the surface of the puppy tunnel? So we have a puppy tunnel, it's all scrunched up, it makes noise. So we try to educate the owners. It's not just for us, go through a tunnel. There's the surface, the sounds, there's place, the everything going on around them that they have to consider as part of their exposure. It's all stimulating. Mm. And like, just like children, too much stimulation isn't good for a puppy or a child, you know?
And I liked the bit you said about choice, because that's such a massively important thing that I think is easily not even thought of or considered. Because as one of the things I often try and say to people in relation to enrichment, but exactly the same principle, is that no animal on earth evolved this brilliantly complex brain to have all their decisions made by somebody else, another species totally. So it's really, really important to consider their, just allowing them to make choices, and I think, as well as learning, it's a place of safety, because if they're not allowed to make choices, they see something scary, they're going to be more scared of it because they know they're not allowed to make a choice and move away and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so we're coming on, Denise, to people skills.
Yeah.
So you say it's about people and not the dogs. And one of the reasons many people give for becoming dog trainers, you know, we've discussed it loads of times at uni on courses and that, is that they don't actually like people. And I would have said that at the start, but now I've learned over the years that it's not that I hate people, it's just that I hate being around them. So I think I've got good writing skills in blogs and getting my point across in words, but face to face with people, I haven't got brilliant skills at that. It's not my skill set at all. But just give us a brief overview of as to why it's important to why you say this, why it's about people and not the dogs.
So as you go through your dog training journey, training dogs for me now is the easy bit. Give me a dog, it's fine, let's train it. It's imparting that knowledge to another mammal that has none of the skill sets that you have. How can I help this person understand and put in practice what it is that would help this dog? How can I help them learn that sometimes less is more? But it's, if I can teach this person, impart the skills to that person, the welfare of that dog is enriched 20-fold. They get loose lead walking, they get taken on walks a lot more, they get freedom on recall, they get to be around people because they're not jumping up, they get to learn to settle in company. How can I help this person help this dog? Because I'm not living with this dog. I'm going to say it's easy for me to take the dog, train it, but then it has to go back to that environment where, what do I do with the dog? The dog's back jumping up with me. So how can I put the skills across? So, I mean, I don't know if you probably are, but tag teach really, really helped in that perspective, in how to succinctly put across a message to somebody. And I do use my air traffic experience, because in air traffic, I was a mentor, a trainer, an examiner. And then I developed the skill set of having to do a really challenging change from writing on paper, which they have done since the beginning of time, to using technical interface, touch screens. And for some people who had been writing on paper for a very technical skill set, to transition to using sort of touch screen technology was really, really hard. So it was a fantastic training journey for people. I encountered people that technically did not have the skill set, or belligerently didn't want to do it. So I ended up with this, I used to end up being the person that they sent off to the units that were struggling with the people skills or the technical skills to help get them over this hurdle. And I always approach people with, there's no judgment here. There's no judgment at all. I'm on your side. I fully understand where you're coming from, which is why I get a puppy now and again, just to remind myself how hard it is. So it's really difficult. But I also have a grumpy dog. That was he was the beginning of all this journey. So I have literally walked in your shoes so I can empathize. And sometimes it is about giving the people the space to think and reflect on, to breathe, to calm down, to slow down, to put into place, just even the simplest of, okay, just breathe, feed your dog. Feed your dog this way. Try this now. How about this? And it's sometimes it's the language you use with them. It's really easy to get barriers up with people with, if you do this, I'm telling you, do this because everybody else is wrong. And then you think, it's worked for me for 5 years. I don't like you. You're telling me I'm wrong. It's how can I coach you to a different point of view? And sometimes it is as simple as when you're trying to change the mindset of an old school type approach where they're into the alpha dominance, which we know no longer is relevant. But if they're still following on that mindset, not through their own fault, they still believe it because it's what they read. How do I challenge that? I don't. I choose my battles. And I choose my battles. And then eventually they see the benefit without you having to tell them, you're wrong. That's not right. So I never enter arguments like that at all. But it's teaching the people because you've got to help the dog. They've got to live with the people.
If you haven't got them on side, then nothing's going to change for the dog, is it?
No, absolutely. Yeah.
You just reminded me again of the old training class where there was a particular one where the female instructor would shout at people. It's like literally shout at them, like the
how to win friends and influence people. Then you know
why they came back week after week. I don't know.
You go, for the welfare of your dog, I need to have you on my side. I need to be on your side. I need to understand where you're coming from and where you want to get to. And it's for me to help your dog by taking you on the journey I need you to do.
But do you get these people who have already, in their head, and I'm not, you know, I'm not having a dig at anyone, but in their head, they already think they're right. They already think they've got all the answers. And so whatever you say is sort of, is almost brushed off straight away.
It's how you say it. So when you're in a class, people watching. I love people watching. So when you're watching the people and you see somebody and you think you're not really on my you're not on my board here. So what can I do? So it's the language. So instead of saying approaching somebody that's, I don't know, keeps pushing their dog's bottom down, it would be, hi, how about doing this instead? What we'd like you to do is do this. Have a go at doing this. Let's see what can happen if you do that. So I never say, don't push your dog's bottom down to do a sit. I might just suggest, well, let's have a go at doing this because let's try it and see what happens. See? Oh, look, so we don't need to touch the dog. And sometimes with puppies, we do try to avoid touching them, pushing the bottoms down because of this and that. But let's go for this. And then when they see it work, they go, well, I'll give it a go then. Or if they see, I mean, it's nothing like peer pressure, which we know. If they see three people in the class of four do it and be successful, well, it's like, well, I'll give it a go then because I'm not going to be the odd one out.
But it just reminded me of something I remember hearing. I think it was Ken Ramirez say once when he was doing a talk. About instead of telling someone not to shout at their dog, it was something, I don't even know if it was that, but it was something along the lines of, let's see what we can come up with so you don't need to shout at your dog. Or he just rephrased it slightly different.
Chirag's really good for some things like that. So reframing the client's, the language that you use with them. The moment you tell somebody, don't do that, they go, well, why not? Whereas if you say, can you try this? Can you try that? How about doing this? It's different in the head mindset.
So we're moving to the part of the show, which I call Enrichment Corner. And obviously I have a big interest in enrichment. So I just like to get,
No, really?
I try and get everybody's view on enrichment. what is your take on enrichment and its importance, and what do you do yourself to ensure your own dogs have got an enriched life?
How long have we got? I love enrichment. Enrichment is as simple as, like, let's just go out in the garden and do a little bit of training, or let's go and do, let me teach you something new, or actually, you're a setter, you need to run, I'm going to take you somewhere secure and just release the beast. Let you run, do what you want. That's enrichment. Or what weirdly I do a lot is when I'm working, my dogs go with my husband to his workshop, which is full of people arriving and coming and going. They might get a journey in the van. They might go out on site with him. So even the simplest, just sitting and traveling in a vehicle with you is... Sweetie? That's one of the setters going, I want to go out. So
he doesn't want to go out. He wants to be on my podcast.
He does, Mr. Watson, Dr. Watson, the English setter. So I do things like that. So just even simple things like just being with you. They're a social species. Enrich their lives, bring them with you, take them with you. But and then looking at what it is that the breed is. So we've inherited a cockapoo. He's 1 year of age. So what's a cockapoo? It's got a cocker spaniel. It's got a poodle in it. Very bright. He's very, very cocker in his mannerisms. So I give him cockery things to do. So I do go find the food, scatter feed, pay attention to me, go find that, go over here, go hunt for that. I do a lot of hunting games with, the setters. So I might set them up. If it's chucking it with rain and it's a Siberian wind from the east, we do a lot of indoor work. So I would put them in one room. I would then go and hide their, it's now toys, but it used to be just go find the food. And I would send one would do a sit wait, a bit of training, and then the other one would go off and find the food or the ball or their toy and hunt. So you have to become really creative after a while, but it doesn't take long for them to go into hunt mode, hunting just a couple of rooms before, oh my gosh, the old boy is shattered after about just two or three goes. The youngster has just popped on the sofa behind me. He'll keep going for about 20 minutes. It's so tiring. Just the simple game of go hunt for something within a small environment. Sometimes I will do guided scent work with them with that, or other times I'll just say, there's the room, somewhere in there, go find it. But they love that. So it's looking to almost meet some of the breed specific desires. But one of my favorite enrichments, it's just a different way of exercise as well, because I do come from the very lazy school of dog training, is I like to take in the summer their food, their meal portions, and we have trees. So in their evening, I'll just take the food out and I will sow the seeds of the food. I've got three dogs, but I will make sure that each dog has a scattered area. So that they're not under pressure, they're hunting, they're sniffing, they're eating, I love it. I love scatter feeding. I really do.
Yeah, I think it's undervalued and sort of underestimated. It's such a simple thing, and which I always think about with enrichment, is that people try to make it over complex, but it can be so simple. I mean, scatter feeding is as easy as, well, it's easier than putting the food in a bowl and placing it on the ground. So it doesn't have to take up loads of time. You can fit it into busy routines, and it's fantastic. And the other one about, you know, like treasure hunts around the house is just brilliant, because whenever I see the dog's nose going, it's just an awesome thing to watch, and it's really enriching for me as well. It's my other interest is in, and my research has been on olfaction. So anything like that is... it's just so amazingly good for them, and it's what they were genetically predisposed to do, is to be sniffing things out and finding things and gaining reinforcement and allowing their brain to work as it was not designed to do, but evolved to do, should we say.
And you've hit the nail on the head there. You find that reinforcing. So do I. I love to hear that bok bok sound of the scent or factory bulb just working its way. Yes. And if it's enriching for us, we're likely to do it more as well, you know? And it's a win-win situation all round. Love it.
Yeah, it's one of the things I always wish people could do on a walk is, and it's one of the things I've written about a few times, is trying to get the person to enjoy the fact that the dog wants to stop and sniff and just get enjoyment from watching them do that. Because ultimately that's what's got to happen. If you think the dog's supposed to be walking along with you, you're not going to enjoy them stopping sniffing all the time. So it's just taking that, it is reframing it really and looking at it as, you know, you're giving the dog that opportunity to get enrichment and to have choices. Again, comes back to having choices to stop and sniff and move on when they're ready to move on and all that sort of thing. And it's so valuable, but it's getting the person to value it themselves and just enjoy providing it.
I mean, I usually say, you know, with walks, if you have like 20 minutes for a walk, doesn't matter how far you go on your walk, you've walked for 20 minutes or you've been out for 20 minutes. I mean, I do the same thing with the scatter. I'm on the back of a golf course here, which has got a public footpath. We go for a walk, we stop. The dogs all now know what's happening and I break up a bunch of treats and I just scatter. Well, I do it one at a time now, but I send them out. They go hunting in the grass. I don't have to walk very far. They get masses because, of course, there's all the other additional scents. But yeah. So we do that as well, quite a lot on the walk.
Yeah, and also to bear in mind, if you was, you know, in a more urban area where you're literally walking around the streets, if say it was a 20-minute walk, that's not much for a dog. If it's just walking, it's not going to make that much difference to their lives. But the ability to stop and sniff and take in the scents for 20 minutes is going to be a lot more enriching and make a bigger difference to their life. So it's always something to consider. Denise, we're going to the best part of the show.
Go on then.
It's called, it's not the end. It's called What's Your Beef? And this is where you get to put the world right and tell us something in the industry that you're not happy with or something that gets your goat, basically.
So my pet peeve as I've gone on my journey is, like I say, right at the beginning, I just went, I need a dog trainer, Yellow Pages, that person. Okay, job done. And as time has evolved and people have expanded, dog world training has expanded and you get into it and then you go through and you do all the education, the damage that can be done by people who unknowingly, with the best will intentions in the world, who have done a couple of courses online maybe, or not, basically it's regulation. It's regulation. So you can do damage just through dog training. So the Veterinary Act was introduced because of the potential damage to animals by the virtue of the fact that you are invasively cutting them and doing nasty things to them potentially. And I think dog training sits within the same remit, is that you can do just as much damage if you don't know what you're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing because you've had a very loose, oh, I like the idea of that, oh, I can teach my dog to loosely walk, I was successful, and then you go off and do classes, people are paying money for somebody who lacks the skill set and the core principles of understanding of what potentially they could be doing, which is where people, as you go up through the dog training qualifications, you become so acutely aware, and then you pick up the dogs that have been through other trainers who've unknowingly, and it's not their, and it's not the public's fault, and this is the irritating thing, is, like I say, I just went to the Yellow Pages. Now you just go online. You don't have to be regulated to be a dog trainer. You do not have to be regulated to do behaviour. You don't. And I think we're verging on the point where this is just unacceptable in a day and age. There's no recourse. You know, I could go to a dog trainer and they really badly damage my dog, psychologically or physically as well, because we know what lead jerks do to dogs. And you just think, where do I go? I can't complain to anybody. Who's regulating this? Where's my recourse in action? So that's my big pet peeve, is the lack. I love enthusiasts, And I love people that go, I really want to be a dog trainer. Can I come and watch your dog classes? Yes, please do. And I mean, as a member of the APDT, we are encouraged to allow people to come and watch. What have we got to hide? We're hiding nothing. I have no problem with you coming and watching my classes at all. Nothing to hide. So it's that, it's regulation, really. And it's the ease by which people set up, become dog trainers. That's fine. But and they
I shall add to your beef. Because what else can they think? What else are they going to believe when they turn up to people who haven't got the skills? And some of these trainers think they're doing the right thing as well. They think the science side of it is all nonsense and they truly believe that because it's just what they've always done. But what hope have people got when you get celebrity dog trainers on the TV using non-scientific methods and harmful methods in a lot of cases on national TV going out to, you know, they've got the biggest audience of any of us. So people are more likely, surely, the layman is more likely to think that is the right approach than what you or I tell them. So to me, I only said something about this the other day, but it's absolutely, sound old now, outrageous that these production companies and TV companies and producers are allowed to put this stuff out there. It's not that they don't know, because people have been writing to them for years and years and years and years and years and years, even going back to when the Dog Whisperer was first came on National Geographic. All that time, people have been writing to these people. They don't care. They care about viewing figures, and that's it.
Now, here's the story. So back in the day, when a certain person came on TV and was the first, not first, Barbara Woodhouse was one of the first ones on TV. but back in the day, I used to think a particular American dog trainer was the absolute bee's knees. Absolute bee's knees. Because after all, he's on telly. He must know what he's doing. And it isn't, and you think, he fixes the dogs. They fix the dogs. It works. Oh my gosh. I'll go copy that. And that's, we know that's the danger. I'll go copy that. And then isn't until you go through your whole education process and then you look back in horror at what you thought was good. And you think, how do I reach the people that would watch this and copy it? And how do I counsel an individual of, that's not exactly how we do it these days. It works. It looks like it works. But what you're not seeing is the emotional underlying responses. And you just have to think, because I'm a crossover trainer, I fully get why they do it. Mm. It's a quick fix. It looks good, looks sexy on TV. But as an educated trainer now, I look back in horror and I think, how can I help Joe Public work through how to choose the correct type of dog trainer when the correct type of dog trainer, bar Chirag and Nancy, have not appeared on TV, do not get the viewing figures. And I do say to my clients, I said, proper dog training is not sexy TV. That's the problem we have. And in fact, with grumpy dogs, I said to the grumpy clients, not the clients are grumpy, but the dogs, we call them grumpy, grumpies are great. I say to these clients, I said, the best dog training session we will ever have with you and your dog is one where nothing happens. The dogs don't seem to respond. The dogs don't do this. It's me helping you on the journey of changing. Things will have happened, but it's not sexy to watch. And that's the problem we have. And that's where regulation comes in. I don't watch the TV programs anymore because I can't physically stomach it. I can't stomach it anymore. It makes me too upset and too angry. And I think there's better ways of me spending my time and energy, which is why my membership of the APDT, we are about educating not just dog trainers, how to be dog trainers, but one of our principal core beliefs and objectives is to educate the public on the type of dog trainer you need to be choosing. And it's, how do we get that message out there? How? But having been a crossover trainer, I fully get the attraction of the other side. It looks quick. It looks easy. It's job done. And it, you know, I've gone through that educational journey, and that was like one of those classical, oh dear moments. What have I been doing? And that took me a while to get over that. How could I unknowingly, I didn't know that was wrong. Mm. As a client, I didn't know what damage I was doing to my dogs. And it wasn't until I saw a friend, it's a long story, but one of my friends went to a dog trainer who had a dog that she had struggled with. We have been on our journeys together. And she said, "Oh, try this person." And I went, "Oh, God's sake, no, really?" And I thought, "Well, you can feed your dog treats." "Oh, so you have to show them what you want rather than stop them doing what you don't want them to do. Oh, you show them what you want them to do." Oh, wow. Okay. And then you end up, and it's just like an evangelical. I went through the evangelical phase. I'm guilty of that. And then I just think you don't win friends and influence people by being evangelical and stuffing it down their throats at all. So I've forgotten where we started now. Pet peeve. And that was it.
That sort of training hasn't gone away. There's one local to me where treats aren't even allowed in the hall. So it's yes, still going on today. And when people get online and go and look for information, they're bombarded with all different sides and arguments and all this. Yeah, so it's even more confusing for them. But I can forgive Barbara Woodhouse. I'm going to forgive her now.
Yeah, I am.
Because I think she was not totally excusing how she treated animals, but I think she had integrity, and I think she was of the time, and you know, it was a different era and no internet, and I can't forgive the people of today that are bombarded with information of why what they're doing is harmful, and they just carry on because they're earning a living out of it. They're earning a lot of money out of it in some cases.
It's that you've just said, which is, if you're educated and you know that what you're doing and how it works, why would you choose that? Why would you choose to inflict pain and suffering because it works on an animal that is supposed to be a pet that's living with you, that's a social mammal? I always say to people, would you do that to a tiger in your house and get away with it? You probably wouldn't survive to the next day. Yeah.
There's a word for it I can't think of at the minute. I'll blurt it out later out in the show.
Cognitive dissonance, I think it is, isn't it?
No, I was thinking something much more simple. It was arrogance. you're mixing me up with an academic. Yeah. So, Denise, we're going to go to the randomizer, I think. This randomizer has changed every week so far. I started off with questions.
Well, that's the random nature of a randomizer. Yeah.
The randomizer itself is random. So anyway, we've ended up with a list of questions. So give me a number from 1 to 33.
28.
What are you proudest of in your life?
Not dog related.
Anything you like. Could be dog related if you want.
You can just
tell us who your favourite child is or something.
I've only got one, so you'll have to do. But what am I proudest of? Oh, gosh. I don't know whether it's my master's degree or the fact that we built our own house.
Well, they're both fantastic, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And
well, I'm going to say that the master's degree, just to put my opinion in, and I often think this because I spent years and years and years sort of a degree was a pipe dream to me for years and years and years and years. And then I went and did it. And I realised it's not actually as hard as you imagine it is. you think people with a degree are all really, you know, really clever, and then, oh, I've got one, look. So then you devalue it a little bit because you've got one yourself. But I always think they're not really that hard to get. But I think doing it with a distinction is certainly much harder to do. So I would be very proud of that.
I have never been so stressed and pressured. My own pressure, I put this on myself, you know. I was late. Well, there was only three of us who were over 50 when we did our master's. It was a lovely group. Absolutely. One of the best places to do it at, because you get straight from degree level people to veterinarians to people like me who are going, this is a hobby and I just need to know more. And then it becomes a lifestyle.
So give us another number, Denise. 1 to 33.
13.
Who have been your greatest influences in the dog world?
In the dog world, okay. My greatest influence in the dog world has been Jean Donaldson. Ooh. And I'm going to have to say Professor Daniel Mills. Am I going to sit with those two? My greatest... I think Jean Donaldson was my my epiphany moment, reading the book and then being really fortunate enough to get onto her program. Or who else could I choose? I love Susan Friedman. But then again, she could just read a telephone directory to me and I would just love her voice.
She's one of my absolute favourites. Yeah, I once said, if I had the money, I would just pay for every talk she's doing around the world and just follow her around the world like some sort of weird stalker.
Yeah. I mean, I was really fortunate to do her Living and Learning with Animals, LLA course, last year. And, she's up there. But I think my greatest influence was probably Jean Donaldson, because that was the beginning of the oh, wow, journey. Yeah, and then,
So give us another number, Denise.
Okay, 5.
Ooh, what advice? We'll get this every week. However I do this randomizer, this question still comes up. So the world must want to know, what advice would you give a previous boss?
What advice would I give a previous boss? I've been really, 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 really fortunate to have really fantastic bosses in my life. What advice would I give them? Spend more time with your family, I would tell them. I don't know, because they have really good life balances as well.
Instead of bothering you mean?
I was in a very, very male dominated industry, and I landed on my feet with all the bosses I've ever had, some of them were ex-military and were brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And what advice would I give them? Get a dog. Which one did, actually? Get a dog.
So, to round things up, Denise, where can people find out more about you if you want them to?
So, they can find out about me. I run dog training. I have a website. It's called Red Dog Training. And thankfully, it's no longer referred to as, oh, you deal with red zone dogs. No, it's because I have Irish red setters. So it's called Red Dog Training. And I'm really, really fortunate that we run that from the Adventure Bark, which is a 7-acre site that I own, which again is fitting in with enrichment and giving access to freedom and space for dogs that just can't be off lead in public. It came about because of my own dog, and I just thought, this is not fair. I can't take him anywhere other than be on a lead. So it's Red Dog Training website. We do, like I say, I'm now hoping to focus more on one-to-one support, and I have a lovely team that do puppy training. She's got her exam coming up shortly, and agility. I love agility for the right dogs. And gun dogs. So yeah, that's what we do. That's where you can find me if you need me, reddogtraining.co.uk. I can't really think of anything else to say.
Cool. This is your last question, Denise.
Go on then.
How can we make the world a better place?
Be kind. Just be kind to each other. You don't have to sit on and become a keyboard warrior. Step away from the keyboard.
Yeah, but it's fun. Move on.
Oh, no, no, no. It's not good for your mental health, Che. Step away from the keyboard.
I think everybody should have an enforced break from social media at least once a week for 24 hours.
It was something one of my previous bosses did actually teach me and impart. And he said, if you're feeling angry, write it, copy it, stick it in a Word document, return the next day. And if you still feel like that, then post it. And I just thought, yeah, because step away. I mean, I rarely comment now because I just think the written words is so easily misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Because you can't have that inflection of voice, the tone's missing, you know. The sentence that you read, I always, was another piece of advice, is write an email, now read it as if you're receiving it. And it's the same with the spoken word. If I talk to you, imagine receiving that conversation. How does that make that person feel? Just be kind. You don't have to be horrible, you know. It's too much energy to be nasty. I don't understand how people have the energy to do it. You know? No.
I'll give it a go. Thanks for coming on the show, Denise. That's the end of the show. Thanks so much to my guest, Denise Armstrong. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Tune in next time when I'll be talking to another great dog behaviour expert. Goodbye. Thank you all so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, click the follow button and share with others. If you didn't enjoy the show, write a strongly worded letter. Not to me, obviously. I'm busy.